Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriell Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In 1996, a kid from Maryland was named the top high school soccer player in the country.
Josh Anderson.
He's totally different than anybody else playing.
So skilled, so talented.
He was very graceful.
Could score goals and just made it seem so easy.
Many consider Josh a soccer genius, a once-in-a-generation kind of player. But he was dealing with something that very few people knew about.
He just kind of seemed dazed almost, or drifting off, I guess, in a way.
I don't know why he didn't see it, but he sure didn't see it.
I felt like I was going into a darker space.
I always, worried that this guy had this amazing talent. But there was just something else going on with him that wouldn't allow him to kind of see it to fruition.
Josh had to choose between the sport he loved and his health. We think of sports as part of a healthy lifestyle. Work up a good sweat, move your muscles, release some stress. On today's show, we'll explore that intersection of sports and health, because often it helps, but sometimes it hurts. Back to the story of Josh Anderson, the soccer genius. Reporter Anders Kelto knew Josh in college. They played soccer together at Brown University. But then Josh simply walked away from the sport one day, and Anders always wanted to know what happened. So he decided to find out.
So where do you want to start?
So let's start at the beginning.
From an early age, it was clear that Josh had a rare athletic gift.
He was really, really well coordinated.
This is Josh's mom, Anna Phillips Wharton.
I thought he could be the next, ballet star. And that lasted one day. What I remember is that he got a loose tooth, or he said he had a toothache, and that was the end of ballet. He would not participate in the class, and neither would his friend. I think his friend got a toothache, too.
Anything to get out of ballet. Next, his mom tried signing him up for figure skating, but that didn't stick either. And eventually, Josh got into soccer.
He was so much more fun to watch play than most of the other kids. It was like watching a dance. I still think he should have done ballet.
Josh rose quickly through the soccer ranks. By his early teens, he had been identified as one of the top players in the country.
You know, when we were all kind of trying out and nobody knew anybody, everybody knew who Josh Anderson was. He was kind of the legend.
This is Mike Rudy, who played with Josh back then.
He had the long, floppy hair that was always in his face, and I'd never understood how he could play with it falling in his face all the time. But he would always kind of do these amazing things on the field, but was never looking to draw attention to himself and never was full of himself. He was just a quiet, gentle person from day one.
Josh was not a soccer guy. He was an artist.
This is Josh's former teammate, Kumi Walker.
And I think that, part of what makes him really interesting was that he wasn't a soccer guy, but he was so exceptional.
Do you remember how Josh would dress?
it actually might be like hipster now.
Ripped up green military fatigue pants that were way too long for him.
Like t-shirts, like small vintage old t-shirts and like flip-flops. And he would always kind of walk like he was in no rush.
When he was in high school, Josh was playing in a soccer tournament in Florida one day. There were dozens of college coaches there watching him, including Mike Noonan.
I mean, he was painting the canvas. There's no question about it.
Noonan was the coach at Brown University at the time.
He had a unique eye for the game, could see things that others couldn't, and then combine that with unique skill and talent. It was like, whoa, he's different than pretty much everybody here.
Josh was the country's top soccer recruit, a talented artist, and a soon-to-be Ivy League student. Things couldn't be better. But toward the end of his senior year of high school, Josh noticed that something strange was happening to him.
I felt like I was going into a darker space. I kept coming back to this, like this feeling of inadequacy and not knowing how to get past it.
You know, things were not okay. I think he was just distant from us.
I was violent sort of at times. I remember they didn't like let me go someplace, so I like took a knife and like cut myself all over and was like bleeding.
After that, Josh's parents took him to a psychologist.
He told us, Jerry and me and Joshua, that we were one of the most functional families he'd ever met, and what great parents we were, and how mentally healthy Joshua was, and there were just no problems whatsoever. And of course, he was kind of this geeky guy, and he was probably really impressed with Joshua's athleticism, and, you know, I don't know why he didn't see it, but he sure didn't see it.
Things settled down for a while. Josh seemed to be getting better. Then he got an amazing piece of news.
Somebody came up to me from the soccer team, and they're like, Josh, you know that you were named the All-American High School Player of the Year? And I was like, no, shit. I was like, that's crazy. It seemed insane.
He was named Parade Magazine's National High School Player of the Year. To give you a sense of what a big deal this is, the same year that Josh won the award for soccer, Kobe Bryant won it for basketball.
And I said to Joshua, you know, congratulations. And I said something like, don't let this go to your head. And he got really confrontational with me. And I'd say this was like a Wednesday or a Thursday. And I knew something was really wrong.
The next day, Josh was hanging out with his friend, Brett Burns.
Over the course of the morning, as we had gone to get food, he was getting like, the only way I can describe it is like more and more wound up. Like he just like talked and talked and talked and talked.
I remember almost moving into a completely different headspace. I felt like I had figured something out. Something like really, really important now.
He felt like he was seeing things that other people couldn't. These connections and brilliant ideas.
So I'm thinking I've like got some sort of secret power. And not only that, all of those insecurities that I'd been dealing with, which I was having a tough time breaking through. And there it was. I got through. And now I've got the power to do whatever I want to do.
Is it a good feeling?
At the time, it was the most incredible feeling I'd ever felt before.
He was, you know, somewhat delusional. He was confrontational with his girlfriend. He was screaming in a way that was completely out of character.
Josh eventually ended up in the hospital and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
It's a mood disorder characterized by both depression and mania.
That's Antonia Baum. She's president of the International Society for Sports Psychiatry.
People who have depression for weeks may either sleep too much, like a hibernating bear, feeling like they're almost like they're walking through quicksand. They may have difficulty literally getting out of a chair.
Most people who are bipolar or manic depressive go through long, low periods like this. Sometimes they'll last weeks or months. And then, suddenly, they'll flip.
When people are manic, they tend to be sleepless, but they tend to be super high energy, and thoughts kind of ping from one thought to another, and they don't string together.
Many people with bipolar disorder become suicidal. While Josh was in the hospital, he did not want to accept the diagnosis.
I was like, you know what? Like, I had a moment. Like, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have, like, you know, gotten so crazy last night. Like, I'll be fine. I don't need to be seeing doctors.
But then his mom told him that his biological father, whom he has never met, also had the illness. And because he never accepted it, his life fell apart.
And that this was, like, something that I was going to have to deal with, you know, for the rest of my life.
He read a book and some articles about bipolar disorder. And eventually,
it started to dawn on me that perhaps this was the right diagnosis.
Josh was put on medication and discharged from the hospital. Over the next few weeks, he finished up high school and tried to come to grips with his new reality. He was supposed to head off to college in just a couple months.
Everyone's just kind of hoping that everything's going to be fine. You know, it's 'cause my mother doesn't know exactly how to handle it. And my father, no one knows exactly how to handle it.
I mean, the psychiatrist was kind of like, you know, there are a million people who have this. They take their drugs. Ted Turner's bipolar. So-and-so's bipolar. You know, just take the drugs and he'll be fine.
But in retrospect, she says,
a 19-year-old with mental illness, away from home for the first time, with two jobs, to go to school and to excel on the soccer team, was, you know, just a recipe for disaster.
Before he went to Brown, Josh's parents got in touch with the dean there. They told him about Josh's diagnosis and his medication.
Our assumption was that he had communicated with the people he needed to communicate with, because I think he had also helped us set up a doctor. So we just assumed, I guess, that people knew.
So when Josh first arrived at Brown, what did you think was going to happen?
Well, obviously, I thought I had the best player in the country and he was going to have an immediate impact on our team.
Coach Mike Noonan.
But the first thing that struck us was that he seemed very, very low on energy. And that's not the way we remembered him in the past. It was like he couldn't get himself going. He seemed to get tired and people were catching up to him in ways that they never did before.
What did you think it was?
That he didn't train during the summertime. But it wasn't that. He was just, "Coach, I did my best." And I'm like, "No." And so we kept on going back and forth and going, there's something not right here.
If there's one medication that has been shown to lower the risk of suicide in manic depressive illness, it is lithium, which is a very simple medication in that it's a salt.
That's sports psychiatrist Antonia Baum again.
But it does have side effects. And when people are manic depressive, they may just feel slowed down by lithium, both cognitively and physically.
I was on lithium, and it was terrible. You can't really play soccer on lithium. I mean,
it really brings you down. Your coordination's a little bit off.
For me, it didn't work well.
Josh and his parents assumed that the dean they spoke with had been in touch with Coach Noonan about Josh's mental illness. But he hadn't. So Noonan was coming up with other explanations for Josh's bad play.
Again, as coaches who are single-minded, we're thinking, oh, you know, part of this is the girl. And she's, you know, she's coming down. And when she's here, you know, Josh is just hanging out with her. He's not concentrating on soccer.
And remember, this was the top high school player in the country.
There was a lot of responsibility put on me in terms of how I should conduct myself and the kind of leader I needed to be on the team, which is completely understandable from his perspective.
But Josh felt like he wasn't fully there, like he was stuck in this lithium haze.
You know, your mindset is foggy. Mm. It sedates you. It almost felt like there was this person before, you know, this person I was before, and then afterwards, it was almost like I became somebody else.
And a big part of Josh wanted the old him back, the gifted soccer player, the artist, the guy everyone found fascinating.
And so, you know, in some ways, I've got this thing that I've got in my pocket.
Like this secret power.
This secret power that allows me to talk a certain way, connect with people a certain way, get people to like me, and that they could see how special I was.
But only if you don't take your medication.
Right.
So he started doing what a lot of people with bipolar disorder do, experimenting with his dosage.
Seeing how much I could take, how little of it I could take, seeing if I could sort of somehow exist in that other space for periods of time without it getting out of control.
One day he'd take half a pill, the next day maybe a quarter pill, then he'd stop altogether. And that feeling, the mania, would be back.
I could do anything.
These new ideas. And I
could be who I wanted to be.
I do remember Josh like staying up all night playing the drums.
I am settled down.
Just been creating.
I am settled down. Don't need to tell anyone. Attracted to me.
Black.
This girl's not only like chain, incredibly
spike,
attractive.
Goth look.
She's like a genius.
You're a cute girl. Creature.
Eccentric electronica fusion type thing.
Space. Marijuana.
I was becoming this person.
Up all night.
Going on.
Eats the drugs.
It was who I was becoming.
Who I was becoming.
Who I was becoming.
The illness was shaping.
Illness was shaping.
Illness was shaping me.
But he owned it.
When he would stop taking his medication, the brilliant, unstoppable soccer player would often reappear.
You know, take over a game and score the game-winning goal.
You know, left foot, he's you know smashing balls in the goal, and right foot, and we're going, oh, that's the guy that we recruited.
It just made you think, man, like, how is it that he doesn't play like this all the time?
One night he was up in Boston visiting his girlfriend. Things got crazy, and he ended up in a hospital. He's still not sure how.
I ended up, like, ran out of the hospital. I slipped out of the hospital and just, like, I had no idea where I was. I'm in, like, the Boston suburbs or Boston, you know, wherever, tough, somewhere near there, and just running for miles and miles and trying to, you know, like, I don't even know what I was wearing. It was freezing outside.
Josh somehow made it back to Brown, and he had a soccer game that night.
And he ended up being late. Like, he came, like, I think a half hour before the game, and coach was very angry. And
he scored two unbelievable goals in the game, and I think we won the game 2-1.
I remember that game. One of the goals Josh scored was one of the best I've ever seen. A left-footed volley from an impossible angle, 30 yards from goal, off of a punt from his own goalie. It was the kind of goal where everyone looks at each other and is like, did you just see that? After the game, Coach Noonan was in the locker room, getting changed.
And there's this frantic pounding on the door. And, you know, we're talking about the game. We're happy we'd won the game. And, you know, Josh looked like the Josh that we recruited, and he scored the two goals. But I opened the door, and his mother's there, and she's frantic. And she starts telling us the story about Josh being in the hospital the night before at Mass General, that he'd been taken to the hospital because he had jumped off of the landing of a second floor, his girlfriend's apartment. And he had been at the hospital that night, and he hadn't slept at all, and that he wasn't taking his medication. And I looked at her and said, what medication? And that's when she told me that Josh had been diagnosed in the summertime as bipolar. And I was like, I was gobsmacked. I was like, what? And I said, and we didn't know this?
So when Josh's mom told you about his condition, did that make his sluggishness and poor performance make more sense?
Oh, God, yes. You know, it was like, aha. And then now I could go do some research because I had never had a player who had, it was known to me that he was bipolar.
Josh spent the rest of his freshman year going on and off his medication, and he had the highs and lows you'd expect. After long, wild nights of partying, with bursts of creativity and some legendary performances on the soccer field, he would crash into a deep depression.
Like a state of like paralysis, where I don't know how to even function. I can't even get up. You know, it's almost like an anxiety attack of some sort where, you know, it's hard for me to breathe.
Sometimes my teammates and I would see Josh in this state.
One time I remember we were even walking up to a practice, I think, and he was walking the other way. And, you know, we just kind of stopped and said, hey, Josh, you know, we got practice now. And he was just kind of seemed dazed almost, or drifting off, I guess, in a way.
Josh's relationship with his coach and the team became strained. And then, in the fall of 1997, he quit the team and walked away from the sport. After he left, Josh had a couple of chaotic years, going on and off his medication. But at some point, he started to think more seriously about that question we all face. Who do I want to be?
I want to, like, accomplish things. And I, you know, it's, you know, I want to be someone who who like looks back on his life and isn't like someone who like ended up in hospitals or lost his friends and family because he hurt them.
Eventually, Josh graduated from Brown 6 years after he first enrolled. Then he started to pursue a new passion, filmmaking. These days, he's living in LA and making independent films and music videos that I would describe as avant-garde and very dark. And he records music like this.
Body still blooms in this very room under the carpenter's gate.
Josh has been taking medication consistently for the past 15 years, a new drug that works much better for him. And he says even though the highs of being manic were intoxicating, he doesn't miss them.
The uncontrollable feeling of it is not attractive to me anymore. It's attractive in some ways because it's like the world's brighter and what I'm doing might seem better, but I try not to go too far, you know. I never, ever intentionally don't take my medication.
This new drug doesn't have the same side effects as lithium. So Josh has been able to play some soccer too.
But it's weird because like I'm older than the coach. But the last time I played with him, I scored 4 goals. You know? And this is semi-pro.
I'd always seen Josh's story as a tragedy. This incredibly gifted player who never realized his full athletic potential. Part of me still feels that way, because I know how great he could have been. But for the most part, I now see Josh the way people close to him do.
Probably, you know, 15 years ago, I would have said I still had a sense of sadness that he hadn't painted the great American painting or written the great American novel or done something spectacular. But he has insight and wisdom, a kind of capacity for love that certainly exceeds almost anybody I know.
I wonder how you see your own story, how you think about your own trajectory and life as a soccer player. Is it a tragic tale?
No.
You know, if I hadn't left, I wouldn't have found myself pursuing this other dream.
Film and music?
Film and music, yeah. And so it seemed like the kind of thing that I could have forever. And I think that when, with soccer, it just didn't, it felt like this thing that was going to end. I mean, I've had so many great experiences and met so many great people. I mean, that would be insane to think of my tale as a tragic tale. I know I'm bipolar, but I'm not that crazy.
Your body still blooms in this very room under the carpenter's gate.
This story was reported by Andres Kelto. It was made possible in part by funding from the Scattergood Foundation. A longer version of this piece originally appeared on the Audible series Gamebreaker with Keith Olbermann. We're talking about the intersection of sports and our health, when sports helps and when it hurts. There are about 460,000 NCAA athletes competing every year. That's the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Baseball, lacrosse, swimming. And most of these athletes earn a degree as they hustle on the field and in the gym every day. Cameron Countryman was one of them. He played football for the University of Pennsylvania until he graduated in 2016. He's 24 years old now. I caught up with Cameron at the place that holds the most memories for him.
We are at Franklin Field. This is the home stadium of the Penn Quakers, and I played all my home games here for 4.5 years. This is where I spent most of my time. This is where I would say I was the happiest, you know what I mean? So some of the big wins or big losses, every time I come back here, I'll come back here and run the stadiums or run around the track to work out. And every time I do that, you know, you think about certain plays that you missed or you made and all that kind of stuff.
Cameron started playing football as a kid. By the time he was in college, his body was showing signs of wear and tear.
I had a shoulder surgery. I had bilateral sports hernia surgery, and then just multiple tears and strains, and that you just kind of play with and are used to. But I think I've had 6 surgeries total, with shoulders getting repaired, hips getting repaired. It's something that takes a toll on you. Mentally, it's exhausting because, you know, you're going to get hurt. It's just when and what kind of injury it is. So a lot of, hopefully, you know, it's something that you can play with and you tape up or ice up, or, you know, you're in the training room all the time just so that you can play, you know.
Were you worried with each of these injuries that it would end your college football career, which would also mean probably a change in your tuition rate and so on? That's a lot of stress.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I don't think you ever stop thinking about that. It's always in the back of your mind. And I think that's one of the biggest stresses is, you know, getting hurt. What happens when you do get hurt? So being able to be mentally strong enough to get set back, overcome injuries, stay in the classroom, keep your grades up, it's all exhausting, you know. But it's worth it, I'll tell you right now, it's worth it. And I wouldn't trade it for anything.
The level of injuries you had, is that fairly typical for a football player in college?
Yeah, I would say, you know, every position kind of has their injuries that are a little more common. But yeah, shoulders, hips, and knees are very popular. And you see guys going down with contact or without, just the twist of the knee, and they're done, they're out for the season. So thank God that didn't happen to me. A lot of my stuff, you know, I was able to play with or play through and then get repaired in the off season.
Get repaired.
Yeah, get repaired. My bionic limbs. No, I'm just kidding. I was a little bionic man by the time my career was over.
And then Cameron also had to keep up with his studies, which often came at the expense of sleep.
A lot of the work it's up to you to get your work done. And you're around some of the smartest people in the world when you come to an Ivy League institution. A little intimidating.
Despite all the stress, Cameron says he would still love to be playing.
So I miss football every single day, 100%. I wish I was still playing. You see how violent football is and the toll that it can take on your body, the toll that it's already taken on my body. I wake up, you know, sore every day, and I didn't even get hit that much. So I would say I miss the competitiveness, because there's nothing like the game of football. There's nothing like being around a group of guys that you call your best friends and going out on the field and playing a sport that is that dangerous, because there's a risk. There's always a risk. So there's a special bond that's unlike anything else that I've ever done in my life.
Cameron Countryman played football at the University of Pennsylvania. He's now working as a business strategy consultant. Now let's take a look at something that you might not even consider a sport: competitive video games, or esports. People do this professionally. Tournaments sell out giant stadiums, and players can win lots of money.
$1 million in that beautiful trophy up for grabs today. We are back in the sold-out Barclays Center in the heart of New York City for the conclusion of the first ever Overwatch League Grand Finals.
That's from the first Overwatch League Championship. Overwatch is a shooting game. So esports is not people playing sports video games like tennis or football. They are playing fighting or strategy games competitively. And players are super serious about this, whether they are professional gamers or not. Some spend as much as 8 hours a day
practicing, playing, working on tech skill, which is specific elements of gameplay. If it's a team-based game, they'll review video the same way that a football or a basketball team would.
Physical therapist Caitlin McGee sees the fallout from all this gaming: wrist injuries, pain, inflammation. Caitlin specializes in treating esports athletes. She says, for starters, many gamers don't prioritize ergonomics.
Somebody sitting not back in their chair, but leaned forward, supporting themselves on their forearms, their back kind of rounded, their head tilted up in order to be able to see the screen since they're slumped so far forward, and then gripping the controller very, very tightly so that all of the muscles are constantly on.
Jun An is a business student, not an esports pro, but he still puts in hours and hours of play every day, and he had a bad setup.
I used to play on my bed while lying down. Like, I put my laptop on my stomach and I played. That's also a reason why I'm wearing glasses. I have very bad eyesight.
A doctor told Jun he was developing back problems and he started to pay more attention to his posture while gaming. So how you play is one thing, but then there's also the wear and tear that comes with doing anything a lot. Here's physical therapist Caitlin McGee again.
The vast majority of the injuries we see are repetitive stress injuries or overuse injuries. Things like stress across the tendons, tendinopathy, where things don't glide as smoothly as they're supposed to, where things become overtired or weakened. Postural-related injuries, if you have a weakness of your core muscles, for example, you might overcompensate using other smaller muscle groups that aren't designed to bear that much strain, which will cause back or neck pain.
And you're also probably not getting a ton of physical exercise.
There is that stereotype of the gamer sitting, you know, in their mom's basement on a couch eating Doritos and drinking Mountain Dew, which the good news is that stereotype is getting more and more outdated. Not only are individual players getting invested in their health, but teams are making it a priority because the health and longevity of their players is exceptionally important. And a healthy lifestyle, exercise, nutrition, sleep habits are a really big part of that.
So let's say somebody comes to your office with one of the injuries you have mentioned. Maybe they have back pain, maybe their hands hurt. What do you do next? What's your fact-finding process?
We might ask to see them actually sit down and play the game so we can see what their posture looks like when they're not paying attention to it for us consciously. We'll look at range of motion, we'll look at strength, mobility, motor control, what causes pain, what makes it better, what makes it worse. And then from there, we'll design a treatment plan like we would for any other patient.
So you give them exercises too?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely a part of it. One of my favorite things about physical therapy is a lot of it is using the body to treat the body. So it's not just about stretching to relieve tightness. It's sure, we relieve the tightness in the moment, but how do we make sure that you don't get this tightness again in the first place? That's why we incorporate those exercises outside of gaming time, so that when you do need to apply those stresses repetitively and very, very quickly over a long period of time, your body has the capability to handle it.
Can our bodies handle this, though? I'm always wondering, you know, it doesn't seem like we're designed to push a button 4 million times over the course of our lifetime. You know, it's just like we weren't made to do this.
Our bodies are remarkably adaptable. And when it comes to the point at which people come to see me is the point at which their body isn't adapting anymore. And that might be because they're putting it in suboptimal conditions to adapt. But when it comes to things like powerlifting or strongman competitions where you see people pulling fire trucks, our bodies weren't necessarily designed for that either, but we're certainly capable of adapting to perform it.
Caitlin McGee is a physical therapist based in the DC area. She specializes in treating gamers and injuries related to esports. We're talking about sports and our health. Right now, we're exploring how people recover from different injuries. Horse racing is a sport where injuries can get really serious. Jockeys have to be very light, but also strong enough to stay on top of a 1,000-pound horse running at full throttle.
Miguel Mena, bravazo, and Miguel Mena, it's international star for Miguel Mena.
Jockey Miguel Mena was competing in New Orleans when the horse in front of him fell. His horse, with him on top, barreled over the fallen rider. Miguel tumbled too, and his foot was crushed. We caught up with him during a physical therapy session. His foot was rigged up with electrodes. There is an electrotherapy machine sending out low-level waves into his foot to promote healing. So you'll hear a little buzz.
You know, it was a race 3/4 of a mile, and I was following a horse on the inside, you know, right behind him, and he broke down and just went down. And I had no time for anything. It just happened so fast. I went over him, and another horse went over me, and we ended up at a hospital. It was scary because the guy that was in front, 58-year-old Jack, and they took us to first aid. You know, he was bleeding through his nose and ears, and he was like next to me, you know, and he was pale. I was scared. I was like, he's dying. Oh my God. If you research the last few years, we have a few Jacks dying and a few Jacks getting paralyzed, and we get some getting some big injuries, you know. I had a great buddy of mine that came from Panama years ago, like, you know, little buddy, he was getting started and he was very likable kid. He was winning races at Ellis Park in Indiana, and people liked him a lot. He would smile, like he had a nice personality. He was 17 years old and he got killed in Indiana. I think he clipped heels and I think the horse stepped on his head. I hope I don't get scared. I think I'm not. I wanna be back.
That's jockey Miguel Mena from Peru. He is still in rehab for his foot injury, but he hopes to be back on the track in a couple of months. Lisa Gillespie from Louisville Public Media produced that story. So far, we've heard about football and soccer, but how about Baloyup or Sagayak? Those are the games of the Washoe, people native to what's now California and Nevada. Their home was the mountains and valleys around Lake Tahoe. People from the community are reviving the sports their ancestors played and hoping the games will be a vehicle for both cultural and emotional health. Laura Clivens watched from the sidelines.
Lisa Enos is witnessing something that for years she's only dreamt of, the traditional Washoe pastimes.
Over here, we have the Mehu Baloyup. So that's the boys' football game. The boys can only kick the ball with their feet, and they're trying to get the ball through the post here.
Elementary to middle school boys shout and sprint. They kick a handmade buckskin ball about the same size as a soccer ball. On either end of the field, the trunks of two aspen trees mark goals. Later in the day, girls will join in.
Girls are the only ones that can use their hand. They can pick the ball up and run with it through the goalpost here. But a boy can pick up a girl and run her through the goalie.
Yes. If she's holding the ball.
If she's holding the ball, you're right. That game I haven't seen in my lifetime.
The girls do have a game of their own, Sagoyak. It's something like field hockey, but their sticks are thin tree trunks, and their ball is a 2-foot-long rope. Go! It's all happening in the scorching summer sun on this athletic field at the Dresslerville Reservation in Gardnerville, Nevada. Some of these games haven't been played in over 50 years. Lisa says she and the other organizers pieced together the rules of Baloyup and some of the other games by asking elders.
Our grandfathers have played it, you know, in that generation previous, but this is the first time this generation of kids has played this game.
All the games are about continuing Washoe traditions and bringing in the language as much as possible.
What are some of your favorite words in Washoe? Not bad words. Yeah, okay.
Hunga Maheji. How are you?
Yeah. Shalimhu. That means girl.
Memdawi. Deer.
Daudish means tree.
Paloo. That means rabbit.
That's what I was going to say.
My favorite word is Washishu. Yeah, the Washoe people.
1,500 people officially make up the Washoe these days. The Washoe have been based around Lake Tahoe and the Sierras for thousands of years. The name Tahoe is actually derived from a Washoe word, Da'au'aga, meaning the edge of the lake. The Washoe were gravely mistreated when settlers came west. Children were sent away to boarding schools that didn't let them practice their own customs, and teachers forced them to only speak English. 10-year-old Coraline Picotti knows this history.
When they took it away, when the Deba'o people, that means white people, made us turn into like them, didn't let us wear the leather and all that kind of stuff. So they made us not speak our language. So we had to bring that back.
Fewer than 20 people are fluent in Washoe today. Adults here say the future of the Washoe is tied to reviving the language. In other indigenous cultures, research shows a strong connection between knowing ancestral language and mental health, specifically around suicide.
These studies show that youth suicide is much lower in communities that are making strong attempts to keep their language going.
Leanne Hinton is a former professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. She's talking about communities like the Washoe, where language teacher Herman Fillmore is working to further ancestral knowledge.
The reason we have all these sticks and everything set up and we're playing on the ground is because this is how we would have played a long time ago.
Herman's teaching the game Hinayaugi, which mixes in rhythm and song.
So, what are these called?
Bones.
Bones. What about Washoe? Everybody say it behuwe. It medim. It behuwe. Our last one.
Just a few feet away, Benny Fillmore watches his son Herman teach. Benny moves his lips slightly as he sings along.
To know that you have this whole internal way of belief, way of thought, way of prayer, that you're not able to vocalize, that you're not able to use or take in internally. It's just like missing a body part. You're not complete.
For decades, the Washoe have been focused on taking back their lost language. In the 90s, they created an immersion school. It had a lasting impact. Most people involved have returned to work with the Washoe to create days like today. Over 100 people came for the traditional Washoe pastimes. At the closing award ceremony, Lisa Enos gets teary.
So these games you guys have been playing today, these have been played for thousands and thousands of years on this very ground that you guys played today.
Kids glow as their names are called and they get flags and ribbons as prizes.
For a first place for the girls was Colleen.
And along the way, Lisa reminds them that really, today isn't about the awards or even the sports. It's about the Washoe coming together.
Jordan!
That's Laura Clivens. She first reported that story for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Sports can be a powerful tool to unify people, to teach generosity and fair play. And some people say sports can be healing. Our last story is about combining the power of sports and the ocean to give people a sense of freedom on the waves. Randy Scott Carroll spent a picture-perfect day on the beach in Wildwood, New Jersey.
It's amazing. It's amazing to be around people that don't judge you.
This is my favorite day of the year.
I got my inner mermaid on. It's a feeling that you never feel before if you're not disabled.
Did you catch the wave?
Lots of them. A big one, too.
Every year, the nonprofit group They Will Surf Again gathers volunteers to help people with disability catch some waves. Some surfers I met were born with conditions like spina bifida that has limited their mobility. Others experienced an accident later in life. However, this couldn't keep the ones here today from doing what they came here to do.
I was so depressed seeing everyone else going down to the beach every summer. And then I found out they got the Adapted Surfing Program. And I'm like, this is awesome. And then to see it grow so much.
This is Will Lawler. He uses a wheelchair after an accident caused an injury to his spinal cord, but stays pretty active with adaptive sports, including rock climbing and tennis. There are 100 surfers here today with a team of volunteers keeping them safe.
We have deep water, mid water, shallow water volunteers, and what they do is basically form a gauntlet.
That's event organizer Carrie O'Connor. He says once the surfers get out into the waves, they ride between the team of volunteers all the way to the shore.
And that way, if they need assistance, if they wipe out, if they fall off the board, there's a swarm of people just right there ready to pounce and to help them, keep them out of the water, get them back on the board, and get them back out riding waves.
when I meet surfer Jack Cavanaugh. He's about to take his turn out on the waves. Jack suffered a brain injury in college and says before days like today, life was a bit monotonous. Then his physical therapist encouraged him to give surfing a try.
She's like, Jack, you're doing this. And I was like, I don't know. It's like I can barely like walk as it is. So now they're going to tell me to just swim.
Jack has surfed here the last 4 years, and he's made quite a name for himself. His first year, he came in a wheelchair. But by his second year, he said he would walk to the event, and he did. The next year, he got up on his knees on the surfboard.
And it's like so much freedom, you can't even describe it. And this like gave me just a little taste of it again.
After years of therapy, Jack can now walk around without too much help. And as his turn came up to surf, he quietly mentioned to me that he might try standing up on the board. So I gathered around with a few other folks who were there to support him.
Did Jack tell you he was going to try to stand up today?
No. Oh, no.
Uh-oh. Yeah, he told me.
Oh, my goodness.
Uh-oh. I was like, did you tell people that? He's like, I don't know. I might do it. I might not. I think I'm going to try. I was like, all right.
Jack is amazing. He's a trip.
Before we know it, yeah. Jack's riding a wave. And all of a sudden, he stands up.
I was not expecting that.
Oh my god.
Attaboy!
Randy Scott Carroll reported that story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Liz Tung. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
Supporting The Pulse, the Coriell Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriell.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.